Hey guys, my guest tonight, Elliot Hamoff, is going to be talking about NASA and the Apollo space program. We'll be right back. Grab your popcorn and snacks. Find a comfy spot, take a seat or lie down, and let me transport you to a place of fantasy, ghost stories, ancient legends, odd creatures, alien encounters, and other magical topics. You may even decide to join the conversation. From faraway lands to your own backyard, with a small dash of pixie dust, turn out the lights and open your minds. The journey is about to begin. Good evening, everybody. Happy Tuesday. I hope your work week's going well. I hope you're doing well. I think I heard you say you're doing well. My name is Charlotte. I'm going to be your host for the next hour. I'm also the owner of the California Haunts Paranormal Investigation Team based out of Sacramento, California. 45 strong up and down the state, which means if you think you might have a paranormal need, we can get to you. It might take us a couple days, but we can definitely get to you. In the case that it does take us to get there in a couple of days, we do have mediums on staff who could phone you and talk to you about what may or may not be going on. And in most cases, they can calm the energy down before we can get out there. Okay? It just calms it down until we get out there. So, yeah. So look us up. We're all over the World Wide Web. Just Google California Haunts Paranormal Investigation Team, and you can reach me via email from any of those sites. Okay? All right. That being said, if you're watching from Facebook and a couple other of the sites, just feel free to hit that follow button if you're on Facebook. If you like what you see in here, I'd really appreciate it. You know, give me a thumbs up. Show me some love, okay? Works the same way over YouTube. YouTube, I've got 1,000 videos sitting over there, and it's all of this show. I'm a journalist, photojournalist, so I like to make changes to the format a little bit. Like tonight, we're going to be talking about the space race and the Apollo astronauts. We're going to be talking about that tonight. So I like to change it up. So go ahead, check out YouTube. If you haven't subscribed already and you like what you see in here tonight, please feel free to do that. Twitch, same thing. It all works the same. And if you're visiting over here from TikTok, some of you do, works the same way. Just show me some love, okay? All right, getting into the space race. I am a space nut, a space nerd. Always have been. My father was, my brother and sister were, and I remember being up. I couldn't have been more than, and this is going to, like, age me, and I don't like to release my age, but I remember being probably barely walking when we went to the moon. And we landed there, and I remember seeing it on my dad's big 24-inch Magnavox TV, and how cool it was even back then. And I just thought it was the greatest thing. And, you know, growing up, all the books and everything, they're like 20 years behind. And so as I'm growing up in elementary school and stuff, I'm trying to read books about the astronauts and going to the moon, and all these books would say is someday we'll go to the moon, right? But anyway, that being said, I'm still a space nut. I'm still a nerd. Nuts. I don't want to say nut. I'm still a space nerd, and I just love it. I have a couple of telescopes, love looking at the moon and all this stuff. But there's a lot that went on during that program. You know, one of my favorite movies is The Right Stuff. And then Disney also had, that was for the Gemini 7 astronauts. And Disney also had their version of a TV series called The Right Stuff. It was really good. I think it ran for one season. It's a shame because it really was a great TV series. Disney or National, I think it was Nat Geo. Sorry, get back. But anyway, my guest tonight, the dog isn't here with me, so she's moving around. My guest tonight, Mr. Hamoff, is going to talk about all this stuff, and we're going to talk about the space race that we were in with Russia, okay? You know, come to find out, I heard Mr. Hamoff on another show, come to find out that Yuri Gagarin, I think this is the gentleman's name, was not the first man to go to the moon. Or not the first man to orbit the Earth. So I want to find out those details from Mr. Hamoff. Well, let me bring him in. He can tell you about himself. And away we go. Let's talk about space. That final frontier, right? Here we go.
Hello.
Good evening.
What an unparalleled pleasure and an honor to be here this evening with you.
It's an honor to have you here. I am so excited.
Let's, okay. Okay. So where did you want to start?
Well, why don't we start with the space race? You know, what was going on? Because, like I said, I've seen the right stuff. I read the book. You know, I saw the one that was on Nat Geo. And, you know, they touch on that. And for the problem with the movie The Right Stuff is that they kind of made it more tongue-in-cheek. It was kind of more like a laughable thing because of the way they presented it. So, you know, let's start at the beginning. Like with Yuri. Let's talk about
you have to remember that at the time in the late 1950s, early 60s, there was a technology race. There was a philosophical race between the Russians, the Soviet Union, the Communist mm-hmm. Empire, and the Americans and the Western philosophies. So with the Sputnik and the introduction of the space race, I mean, there was people like Eisenhower that couldn't care less that the Russians put Sputnik up into space. But the fear of the Americans was that the Russians could put something into orbit means that they could reach any point of the Earth with a nuclear device. So that's when the space race actually got started. And this whole thing about Yuri Gagarin, don't forget that the Russians were a totalitarian government at the time. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing a couple of shows on the space race, mm-hmm. is I found out that the Russians, they never publicized anything that was not perfect. Okay, you'll not see any failures, anything going wrong, any problems that the Russians encountered. Now, in America, now, do you remember people like Alan Shepard?
Yes.
That were a part of that Right Stuff, okay? Mm-hmm. And that was the effort just to get somebody up into space and then back down. They weren't even looking for orbiting somebody. Well, the Russians were doing the same thing, but they never publicized it. And there were like five or six cosmonauts that ultimately died and was covered up. And so the thing is that I met a translator whose uncle knew the real first man in space. His name was General Vladimir Ilyushin. He was a colonel back then, and he was the American, he was the Russian equivalent of a Chuck Yeager, okay? And he was launched into space a week before Yuri Gagarin, but there was a guidance problem. The tracking station at Turd Island, now that's also a great storyline. Mm-hmm. The tracking station at Turd Island, which is but halfway between Hawaii and Midway Island in the South Pacific. And don't forget, is like there were tracking stations throughout the world because they only had limited space. So they tracked that mission, and Ilyushin crash landed in mainland China. So the Russians couldn't present him to be the returning conquering hero of the Soviet Empire if this guy is in China. So they had to cover it up and make a big story. But the problem was that this guy, Ilyushin, was the son of one of the greatest aviation designers in all of Russia. So they weren't going to just like cut this guy loose. This was the guy that created the Ilyushin II, the Stormovik, tank buster, like a troop support plane, was one of the most famous aviation designers in the world. And so they finally got him to come back. And because the Russians were a totalitarian government, they did not publicize the mission. They did not publicize his flight. And it just was covered up. And so then a week later, they put up this guy, Gagarin, who was a nobody. I mean, you're talking about the difference between a Chuck Yeager, a gum-chewing, beer-drinking, womanizing, had more records than any other person, American or Russian, and this guy. And so when he crash-landed, they just said, okay, well, we got to get somebody pretty. and inexperienced, and we don't care if he's expendable or not. And so Gagarin went up into space, and yes, he did orbit the Earth, which was an accomplishment, but right. It was the fact that he wasn't the first man in space. Now, you're going to go fast forward 7 years mm-hmm. when he is accidentally killed. And so he was going through mood swings and depression, and nobody could figure out why this guy was going through mood swings and was depressed. He was the greatest hero in the history of humanity. He was given parades, he was given medals, and he was just getting drunk, and he just wasn't caring, and he was depressed. And what happened was it was the hilarious that the Russians were never allowing him to fly, but he was becoming such an embarrassment because of his alcoholism, because of his depression, because of his mood swings. And then the Russians, they killed his best friend in the first Soyuz mission, which is another story that we did a whole documentary on. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is that he's not allowed to fly until the Russians ultimately, they give him permission to fly. He goes up in a jet, and the first time he goes up in a jet, he crashes. And it was, and this guy, Ilyushin, he was mm-hmm. the one that was put in charge of the accident investigation committee. And when we went and we interviewed him, he would not talk about his mission because he didn't mm-hmm. want to make waves and get the ire of the KGB, but he did tell us that he never found the body of Gagarin in the crash. Is the ejector seat was in the jet, and they never could find the body, and the whole accident report was put under wraps and was never released to the public. So there was like a lot of like craziness going on. But that was like the start of the space race, and it was the craziest competition. And, you know, we lost a whole bunch of people in our space race. Mm-hmm. We lost Ed White and the whole Apollo 1, and then we lost the Gemini mission, the crew of the Gemini mm-hmm. mission. They were coming into like Houston, and they crashed into a warehouse in the fog. And so there were a lot of astronauts that passed away in that just crazy time. But it was the thing that there was everybody in the country was pulling together, was working together.
When you talk about Ilyushin, it rang a bell because I flew to Hungary with my family when I was around 12 or 13. And what plane did we fly on? It was Czechoslovakian Airlines, and it was an Ilyushin 62.
Right. Well, and you see, and this was the whole thing. We went and we saw Ilyushin. We interviewed him. He just would not want to go on camera, but he told us his whole story that was the subject of one of our documentaries that we did like 20-something mm-hmm. years ago called The Cosmonaut Cover-Up. And his mm-hmm. father and like the Ilyushin Aviation, they make most of the commercial planes mm-hmm. nowadays for the Russians. They have a huge complex. And the thing is that the younger Ilyushin, he was not somebody that was interested in doing that. He was more of the test pilot. He was the fighter jet. And so he started working for the Sukhoi company, which is kind of like Henry Ford's son working for Chevrolet kind of thing. And so it's just like the dynamics of those Russians are crazy. They keep secrets for life. And, you know, right. it's like they were telling me the whole story, but kind mm-hmm. of like telling me how they didn't do it, but it's the way they say that they didn't do it. It's mm-hmm. kind of like he said, well, I came back from China, or I was sent to China because I was in a car accident. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, that's a bunch of baloney, that right. thinking that a high-ranking Russian official and the son of a Politburo member who was awarded the Hero of the Soviet Union is not going to mm-hmm. be sent off to like primitive prehistoric China back in those days, mm-hmm. you know, for acupuncture or whatever. So,
how accurate was that movie, The Right Stuff?
Well, you know what? In every space movie, you have to add a little. You have to have a little angst. You have to have a little mm-hmm. drama. Because these guys, for the most part, they're just like dull, boring test pilots. That they're doing an exciting thing, but these guys mm-hmm. had a job to do, had a mission to do, and the weirdest thing of all was that we interviewed all of the early NASA officials and the doctors who did all the testing, and it turned out that they tested women. Who were pilots, who were test mm-hmm. pilots working for American companies. And it turned out that they were better suited, that the hospitals and the testing facilities at the time mm-hmm. was very limited, and mm-hmm. it was in New Mexico. And the women tested better than the men in oxygen consumption, in being smaller for the mercury capsule to fit in, that they had better reaction time. But what was the real reason that there were no women involved in the early part of the space program was because all the rocket technology was the greatest top secret national security that all of these men had to have military clearance for top secrecy. And mm-hmm. so it's kind of like it wasn't like a sexist thing. It was protecting the national security of the country. But I just wanted to just to put out there that sure. the women did test better than the men in the early Mercury astronauts. That was ultimately proved out with like Sally Ride eventually, that she showed yeah. that women could do just as well as the men.
Absolutely. Now, before the Russians actually went into space, were they using animals to train them and test them like we were with the chimpanzees?
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, they sent up a dog in space after the Sputnik. And they were doing all kinds of, but you see, with them, they didn't care. People, dogs, they right. put up five or six. If you remember, I mentioned about Alan Shepard and the Redstone right. rocket, that they were doing the same thing, but they were not publicizing it. And they mm-hmm. were thinking of sending up a person, putting up a cosmonaut on top of a rocket and shooting him into like China, or shooting him into like some nasty part of the world where he could then do whatever and be a spy and whatever. And so there were five or six that were killed, that were airbrushed out of all the group pictures of the cosmonauts. And mm-hmm. so it's like the Russians at that time, they didn't care. People who died, or dogs and cats, it didn't really matter to them one way or the other.
And this is all really interesting to me. Now, when we started testing these test pilots towards making these flights, how long of a process was that?
Well, it was a matter of years to just develop the technology. And then there was the Mercury missions, which were just the mission just to see if we could live out in space as a single person, and just to go and see if we could come back and have the guidance to come back and safely return. And then mm-hmm. there was the Gemini missions, of two people, and that was testing all the technology of docking together, of tethers, of extravehicular activities. And so that was really exciting testing that almost killed several of the astronauts because they didn't really know what the hell they were doing. And so that was something that would needed to be tested. And then, of course, you know that in 1962, John Kennedy made a speech at the United Nations not to have a space race, but to have a joint effort to go to the moon. Mm-hmm. But the Russians saw that as a sign of weakness, and they just said, okay, poo-poo on that. But so it was the technology that had to be developed. I mean, when Kennedy was at Rice University and trying to pitch his, going to the moon by the end of the decade, is none of that technology was available. Well, none of that technology was tested. And so this was like going at breakneck speed to do stuff that we never did before. So that was something that was never planned, and never the process was never in question. It was just, how do you get from point A to point B as soon as possible?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the scientists that were working on this stuff, because, you know, my understanding, and my father, again, also was an aviation nerd. So, I mean, he took me to the air museums and all that, you know, I've been everywhere. And, you know, when you think about the scientists that were working on our program, they were German, correct?
Oh, almost all of them were. Mm-hmm. I did a documentary called Bob Truax, the Navy's rocket man. And he was the one who was involved in rocketry, early rocketry in the 30s and 40s, and he was the first American to debrief Wernher von Braun when he came to America. So it was like at the end of World War II, everything was chaotic. And as my understanding was that Wernher von Braun and all of his scientists, all of his people that were developing their V2 rockets and things, is they essentially said, okay, we can wait for the Russians or we could go to the Americans. So let's go to the Americans. And what happened was all of the knowledge base went to the Americans, but most of the hardware was taken by the Russians. And so it was like a split. And so you know what? It's history will judge these people. That's above my pay grade on how many tens of thousands of people were killed by Wernher von Braun. But yet Wernher von Braun was important in developing our rocketry and our space program. And so you can't really judge a person. And all of his assistants, all of his scientists, they took all the papers and they all joined forces with the Americans. But from what I understand of my Bob Truax show, that when he was developing his relationship with von Braun, it's like von Braun was interested in just like the V2 rockets, okay, in rocketry, in developing technology. So it's like he wasn't. You know, like a rabid Nazi, kind of like, you know, killing Jews or killing, you know, Londoners or whatever. It's just he was just wanting to develop the technology because he knew after the war that there was that potential. And, you know, there's a funny story that there's what I think is a hoax, but it's possible that von Braun was also wanting to put people inside the V2 rocket to see if they could survive a trip into space. So, I mean, he had like that forward thinking.
Now, when they designed the lunar module and the capsule itself for the end of the rocket, how did how they did that? You know, to get the right sizing and everything, because that had to be a complicated thing too.
Well, you see, it is a funny story. Now, could I go into how I first got into
yes
the space documentary business in the first place
right.
was that back in 1990, I formed my own production company, Global Science Productions. And you see, the thing is that I was at a Christmas party back in 1993, and a bunch of us were talking about the old pulp fiction writers of that era between like World War I and World War II, and the sci-fi dime novels of that time, written by like L. Ron Hubbard and Frank Pohl and Ray Bradbury and all that, Isaac Asimov, about space travel, about going to the moon, about going to other planets, and then the conversation at that time led to how those old time writers about space travel became reality with such scary accuracy. And the thing is that someone then like whispered in my ear back then that in July of 1994, that would be the 25th anniversary of the Neil Armstrong's walk on the moon. And wouldn't it be great if we did a documentary on all the real life astronauts that walked on the moon and ride on the coattails of that anniversary? Well, I thought it was a brilliant idea. And as fate would have it, like we literally bumped into the writer of the Apollo 13 movie, Hanks blockbuster Apollo 13, and he gave us these great ideas for other documentaries on Apollo missions and astronaut shows to produce, including a companion documentary to the Apollo 13 movie. But it's like, getting back to the point, is that there was such a tremendous success that we ended up doing like over a dozen one-hour TV documentary specials that aired on PBS, and many of them are still available on a wide variety of streaming sites, and even DVDs can be found on Amazon. But when I was producing the 2008 Hollywood Christmas Parade, I met up with a guy named John Goodwin at Galaxy Press, who sells those Fit adventure books and audiobooks of the L. Ron Hubbard era back in the 30s and 40s, who inspired some of the astronauts and the NASA officials. When we were interviewing them, they were telling us that the design and the construction of these different parts of the moon mission was really based on the dime novels of the 30s and 40s, because it made so much sense. And so it's just like the interconnection was just the craziest thing. And so I was totally blown away with how this guy, Hubbard, was so accurate in writing his sci-fi books and to what the real missions were. So it's like, John Goodwin was telling me that he has like a thing called Writers of the Future. He has a competition every year. And so he said, Elliot, you have these documentaries you put together that are, you only use like three or four sound bites for each documentary on each of these astronauts, each of the NASA officials. And, I would interview these NASA people for like an hour, sometimes like 2 or 3 hours at a time. But it's just, we never could get like the totality of their experience. And so he suggested that I put together a book of just like of the transcripts, which is like non-diluted, non-editorialized, but just what these astronauts and NASA officials went through and their stories. And I put it together in a book called like Space Pioneers. You could find that on Amazon.com and or off my website. So it's hoping that these transcripts of the real life astronauts will be given to like the future generations of writers and sci-fi people.
Well, it's history. It's something we should never lose, because it's a huge part of our history here.
Right. And this is my documentaries and this book that I just finished is those are like the real stories from the real like horse's mouth, so to speak. And so I just felt it was such an honor to have been able to interview these guys. And the book, you would love it, because it tells so many trivia stories, tell so many funny stories that NASA people, it's like, for whatever reason, they thought that by just like putting together like these whitewashed, sterilized versions was just going to get people excited. But right. In reality, we were falling out of our chair laughing when we were interviewing these guys. And it's like one of them left a Bible on the lunar rover. Another guy took a family picture and he left that on the lunar surface, just like to kind of like involve the whole family. Uh-huh. In the trip, and then there's like astronauts who were playing practical jokes on each other. They were like, you know, one of the astronauts, you know, they keep their feces you know, for analysis. So he's right. Like in a bag. So he like puts his feces bag in the food compartment, hoping that another one of his crewmates was going to like try to reach in for a midnight snack. So wow. It's just so, and then. And then it's like, the backup crew of one of the missions was putting Playboy bunnies pictures on the checklist of the astronauts. So they're on the moon and they're like going through their checklist and they're seeing the Playboy bunny and they're laughing, all laughing. And the NASA people are saying like, "Well, what are you laughing about?" And like, you know, they can't tell the NASA people. So these are all like stories. And then of course. And then, of course, you know that Neil Armstrong, you know, just to give you like a little sample of right. Like, you know, the trivia, is like, you know that he blew it, his line, his famous line, most famous line of all time. He blew it. He, you know, it's like his one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. It was supposed to be one small step for a man, okay. One giant leap for mankind. So it's like he blew it, and so it was like, so we all know the first words on the moon. Do you right. know what the last words on the moon was?
I have no idea.
Okay, well, I see this is all like part and parcel of something that would be interesting. Is that Gene Cernan, just before they're leaving on the Apollo 17 lunar module, he said, okay. Let's get this mother out of here. And then they left. So that was like, and then the mission after, and I'm just telling you, like, these are like cute little things.
Absolutely.
The mission after Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, the Apollo 12 mission, mm-hmm. was a guy named Pete Conrad. Right. And he was the commander of the Apollo 12 mission. Well, he got into a fight with some communist journalist who was saying that this was all like, you know, this kind of peace and, you know, tranquility and all this kind of like peace and kumbaya kind of stuff with, mm-hmm. you know, one giant leap and all that. That was just like American propaganda or something. And that mm-hmm. some American propaganda. And Pete Conrad was saying, no, it wasn't. It's like the NASA people didn't say anything about one. And so they had a bet for like $1,000 of, okay, so it's like, you, let's figure out what I'm going to say when I go to the moon. And so he says, okay, I'll say something like, you know, that might have been one giant leap for Neil Armstrong, but it was one giant leap for me because I'm just such a small guy or something. And mm-hmm. so like they bet $1,000 that's what he's going to say when he first gets on the moon to make $1,000 bet. And so when they landed on the moon, he says, well, that was like, you know, one small step for Neil, but it was a big one for me because I'm so small. So you do that kind of stuff, and then of course the astronauts, they were getting lost on the moon, and they were doing all of these testing. You know, I love to get to talk to people who say, well, we didn't go to the moon, or there's like, you know, a breeze coming in for the flag. And it's all like the craziest, stupidest thing that they don't see the big picture. But there was like an experiment that was done by the Apollo 15 mission, Dave yeah. Scott, and he had a feather in one hand and a hammer in the other hand, and he released them both together, and they both hit the moon at the same time, which proved the Isaac Newton law. So you can't repeat that in an Earth gravity and an Earth atmosphere. And to have made like a huge set of like having the lunar lander and this and sucking the air out would have meant you'd have to build like a container that would have cost like billions of dollars because it would have gotten crushed by the atmosphere. So it's like all of these things. And then, of course, seeing the lunar dust kicking up.
Right.
Is that's like from not an Earth gravity. And so there's like a dozen other experiments that they did that we did go to the moon. And then I have fun with these astronauts when we're interviewing them because each one of them have been like harassed like for years it was just all one big phony stuff. And they keep on saying, you know, look, it's like it would have been costing more to do a cover up than to go out, just go to the moon itself. Or it's like, you know, they kind of like make a joke and say, well, I don't know where they sent those other guys, but they sent me to the moon. So I just loved meeting all the astronauts and all the NASA officials. And they were all terrific guys that we put in all these shows. And, you know, they're all like, you know, they're all taking their lives in danger. But they had a job to do. I mean, and to think the thing that I was like so impressed was they look at the Saturn V rocket had something like 6 or 7 million parts to it.
Right.
It was huge. It was 6 or 7 million parts. That means even if 0.1% or 0.01% of the parts would fail, that still means there's like 10,000 pieces that would fail on that mission. And so it's kind of like the astronauts were focused on, well, okay, if anything goes wrong, that's their problem. I'm just involved with like my little universe on the top of the capsule. And so when you were mentioning about how did they design the capsules and how did they design the modules, and how it's like it all, believe it or not, it all traced back to these dive novels from the 30s and 40s and Wernher von Braun and his early rocketry carried through to the Apollo rockets. So that's like a crazy setup for sure.
I think about the computers that they were using because I know when my mother worked at Pacific Bell or AT&T at that time, she took us into the master computer room for the phones. And I mean, it was huge. It was so big that these computers were so huge. I mean, NASA must have had these really big facilities to have these computers in, so that they could control the capsules and stuff.
It's too unbelievable to have people of present day even comprehend what they were doing. They are how small the computers were.
Right.
The computers were so primitive and so small compared to today is like your watch that you have or your car has like 100,000 times greater capacity than the computers that were on the Apollo rockets. And they had like IBM punch cards. They had reel-to-reel magnetic tape for computers. Entire rooms were devoted to computers. To have your computer set. So you have to remember that the computers back then, and when I got my first, I'll tell you, when I got my first Apple IIe computer in 1983, it was a 64K memory. 64K is like a page or 2 pages worth. And that was, and you know, there were people coming from all over the blocks around me that were just like, oh, and on, just like say, going crazy that you could do that and have it have a memory and have it, we had little 5-inch floppy disks.
Right.
So it's just like, it's insane for any of the people now to the like 40 years ago, that it was like 64K. And then there was a card you put in and you doubled it to 128K. Right. And like you're saying that you have enough time to hack into NASA or you have a hack into the Department of Defense. And so now it's like you're into terabytes and gigabytes. And so, but back then the computers had a job to do. So they only had one or two jobs for it to do. And they did it perfectly. It's like so incredible. And we, you know, it's funny that we interviewed the guys that designed the mission control room. That you see in all the movies. And we interviewed the people that were in charge of those computers. I mean, and they were like, you know, you had to have like a warehouse full of coolant to cool the computers. They were overheating so much. And then, of course, you know that the first man landing was almost aborted at the last second, because the computers were running so so fast that they were said like there was alarms and it was the kind of thing that just before they were going to land, there was an alarm that the computer came on, said, "I can't understand what's going on here. There's too much stuff going on, so I'm just going to leave that and carry on. So you guys got to know if there's a problem or not." And so there was that kind of a thing where there was like one guidance guy. I think his name is Steve Bales. He made the decision at the last possible second that go. It's like that's a mistake, and it wasn't a problem with the computer. It's just that it was just so much it overwhelmed the computer. But everything is still go. And I think he ended up meeting the president or something. From that kind of, but those guys all had eyes for blood, that's for sure.
I remember those IBM punch cards. Again, that, you know, the AT&T over here had those. My mother used to bring them home for me. And they also had, if I remember right, they also had like these silver little squares that they would tape over the punches in the cards to tell the computer what to do. And when you think about, like you say, when you think about the technology that they used to get hold of Ray the Moon and back, It boggles the mind. It's incredible.
Well, they were using slide rules, and I don't think anybody knows what even like a slide rule, how it works. But it's like that was a whole different setup. I mean, you had to be a total brainiac and a total fan of space to be a part of that. And you know, it's like nowadays, but it's all what I'm seeing is that our dependence on computers is now so great that there's a colleague of mine that says, you know, that our evolution, like he's a Darwinian evolutionist, is like our evolution has ended as of the beginning of the computers. And as our brains got bigger through evolution and natural selection, it's now computers that are expanding. And so we're just going to be like slaves of these fifth and sixth generation computers when their memory is going to be as great as ours. So I'll just leave that for the next generation to have to worry about. I'm not going to have to worry about that.
Well, as you were saying that, I keep going back to the astronauts and how, you know, the capsule was completely computer controlled at one point. And they took a stand because if something went wrong, they wanted to be able to control the capsule, right?
Well, that's something that was a transition from the Mercury capsules that were minimally controlled by NASA, but the astronauts at the time and the pilots at the time, the test pilots at the time, wanted control, and that was something that was necessary, that because we didn't have all of that in computer form. But as the evolution of NASA evolved, and what happened was that Apollo 7 was the test. It had Wally Schirra in it and Walt Cunningham. And what happened was that the mission control room, they wanted control. They wanted to tell the astronauts what to do and how to do it. And that's how they're going to get to the moon, is through mission control, not flying by the seat of your pants like they used to do it as test pilots. So Wally Schirra was of that old guard, the old school test pilots. And so he pissed off the mission control guys so much that none of the three astronauts that went on Apollo 7 ever flew again, that they were so pissed off that they had to have a, like, you know, like a Jesus moment of, okay, this is what's going to happen if you don't listen to mission control and listen to the computers. But there were times when the astronauts actually had to override the computers. There was a time when Apollo 12 was just lifting off and they were hit by a bolt of lightning and that shorted out all of the electricity and the guidance system. So they had to really fly that thing for a while and then boot up and boot up the computers again. So luckily, the computers came back up on again. And then, of course, the Apollo 13 mission was totally the astronauts were flying that thing. You know, the guidance and the parameters were generated, but that was not a computer thing at all. That was especially after the initial blow up of the oxygen tanks. So there were times and when it was necessary for the astronauts to take over and to fly the vessel.
Now, when you talked to like Neil Armstrong and, you know, Shepard, did they describe what it was like being like out in space? Because I know, you know, the video coming back from NASA that everybody saw publicly. But what happened when the cameras were off?
Well, you see, the thing is from the astronauts that I talked to, and this is just like my own opinion, it's just my opinion, is that there was the total range is some of the astronauts couldn't care less about where they were going or what they were. It was just a job to do, that they had to do it, and that was it. And they just followed instructions, and they were in a great place, in a nice place, in a new place, and that was it. It didn't have an effect on them when they came back. It didn't have any effect on them when they were out there. It was just like some of the astronauts were just like very focused, and that's all they knew. That's all they wanted to know. There were other astronauts that were very spiritual. I mean, there was one of the astronauts did ESP experiments with him projecting his mind to earthbound people to see if his energy would then be going back to the earth. There were some people who were looking up and picking up their hand and saying, you know, that 5 billion or 6 billion people are under my thumb, you know. So it's like, it was just like for some people, and then the astronaut who left a Bible on the lunar rover, you see NASA, they just like started freaking out when they heard all that kind of stuff of like, you know, leaving Bibles and pictures and stuff like that on the moon. It's like they didn't want to get into any kind of potential controversy. But that's what some of the astronauts were very spiritual. And then, of course, like there was another astronaut, the last one, Harrison Schmitt, that he was just like a like a pig in heaven kind of thing, because he was a scientist. He was actually a real scientist and a geologist that was out there picking up rocks and analyzing them and seeing them and discovering all these new things. So he was having the time of his life as an exciting thing. So it's like the whole range of diversity.
Now, the question I have too, since you've talked to the astronauts, you know, you get the impression from these different movies that they really didn't want to do PR. You know, like you say, it was a job to them, and they hated that PR stuff. So did it kind of irritate them, you know, when they had to be on camera and being filmed live when they were on the surface?
Yes, and this is something that I have experienced in interviewing all the astronauts that I have over the many years. I mean, I've not only interviewed the Apollo astronauts, I interviewed all the women astronauts, and I interviewed a bunch of shuttle astronauts. And it's kind of like they couldn't care less about PR promo stuff. That's not what they did. That's not what they're there for. They were test pilots. They were experimenters. They were pioneering new things. They were in doing things. They weren't like monkeys that just like we're on a chain kind of thing. They were guys that are doing. Okay, leave the PR for the PR guys. Leave the promo stuff for the producers. You know, it's like. And then the funniest story is that now he's passed away, so now I can tell, is there was one of these Apollo astronauts that would not give anybody any interviews to anybody, and he was just like somebody that didn't give out autographs and didn't do any. His name was John Young. He was the commander of the Apollo 16, and he was also on Apollo 10 when they went around the moon. And it's like he wouldn't give anybody any interviews because he was fed up with all these like BSing.
Sure.
So we gave him an opportunity, and we went to him and we said, well, we want to do a show on the Gemini project. When they were testing, they're actually like testing new technologies and going out there and testing stuff and doing new things. And they were flying by themselves a lot of the time. There was no such thing as like computers because they were testing all this new technology. So they had to do all of the things. So that was the thing that he loved. He loved to talk about that. He didn't care less about talking about the moon stuff. So we got him to talk about the Gemini. And then while he were there, then we talked about the Apollo stuff. And so we ended up doing like an Apollo 16 movie and a Gemini movie. And I'll never forget, like 25, 30 years ago, this was, we sent him a copy of the rough cut of the show. And he sent back a bunch of his comments and said, good job, guys. And, John Young. And my partner stole that and he sold it on eBay or something for $1,000 or something, because he would that the signature, the autograph was so rare. This guy just didn't do anything. And so that's all part of the guy, the thing that these guys were all. And then, of course, Sally Ride is all of the other women. There were six or seven other women that were the first group of the astronauts, is they were so happy that Sally Ride got to be the first one in space because she had to go on all these tours and lectures and all that kind of stuff. And so they were all happy that they could just do their own thing and their and NASA and leave it all and leave Sally with all of that kind of craziness. People would be asking her did you cry? And when you were in space and, how did you handle your mother or something? So it was just insane stuff that she had to, that was the same with the Apollo astronauts, but I get it because the Apollo missions were the biggest mark of success for NASA. And that was all in the getting money for NASA because the interest in NASA was diminishing. I don't know if you remember, at the end of the Apollo missions, at the end of the Apollo missions, President Nixon was given a number of different projects, like going to Mars, setting up a space station, or developing the shuttle. And so it's like there wasn't enough money to do all those things. And so Nixon just said, okay, what's the cheapest thing we could do in space? And they said, okay, well, developing the shuttle. And so that's how the shuttle got started. But there was no place for the shuttle to go.
Right.
Because there was no space station and there was no going to Mars. Because we won the space race and the Russians dropped out years before. Because, and that was like, you know, their own problems, their own internal problems, because their, like, head of the space program did not have a protege, and he died suddenly, and then everything just went to crap. So it's like they didn't have any money left, and that was how NASA was getting it, by putting these guys up as, like, you know, the first man on the moon, and then, and Neil Armstrong was very, very reluctant. He was not at all interested in doing any kind of interviews at all. And it was like, and Buzz Aldrin, we interviewed him like two or three times. We could hardly shut him up. He was wanting to go on to Mars, and he was like wanting to go on to other planets. And he actually has the most brilliant concept. I'm telling you, this guy, he has the most brilliant concepts of going to Mars. I wouldn't be surprised if Elon Musk didn't already contact him and set like some ideas together.
Now, my question with this too, you know, when you look at the space program now and what's going on, and I don't think a lot of people realize this, because like you say, NASA ran out of money, and you know, the guys that we were putting up on the space station, they had to come back somehow. A lot of them came back with the Russians. You know, because I remember watching the splashdowns and the lands on Earth and stuff. Did we take kind of like a step back in a way? Because we're kind of starting over right now.
Yeah, this is what happens to technologies and civilization. That's why we can't put together pyramids. Okay, the technology was available then. It's not available now. We could not possibly recreate building pyramids. We obviously cannot possibly recreate the old Apollo space mission. We don't even have the blueprints anymore. I once contacted the president of Rockwell and said, do you still have the blueprints? And they said, no, they all like threw them all away when Rockwell was bought out, or Rockwell went bankrupt, or whatever. So it's like the technologies goes in waves and cycles.
Right.
And so as the desire increases, then the technology increases. And I do think that there is going to be a space race. And Harrison Schmitt told me like 20-something years ago that there was going to be another space race between the Americans and the Chinese to go to the moon to go and mine what's called helium-3. Is a light element on the moon's surface that could be harvested and brought back and used for fuel in fusion reactors. And that's because it's now not a matter of space race. It's like a race of who goes there first and whose philosophical approach is superior. It's all now a process. It's now all working together to go to a certain spot. So that's why we're not going to Mars in anywhere near the speed that we did go to the moon, because it's a process. And so going to the moon and setting up a colony on the moon, and you have to go to the moon to do something, to look for life, to set up a mining colony. So there has to be like a reason that sparks a going to the moon or going to Mars. And I definitely think 100% that there is life on Mars. That water is in the porous rocks about a foot underneath the surface, because there's like ultraviolet radiation is bombarding the surface. So there's no life on the surface, but underneath there's definitely was water. And where there is water, there is life.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. It just struck me, even, you know, when I was younger, in my high school years when the space shuttle was flying. And it struck me, you know, we were landing on the moon, we were, you know, we were splashing down, doing all this stuff. And we to me, it felt like we took a kind of step backwards. Because at that time, we couldn't, you know, the runways on the moon, obviously, to land the space shuttle on. So I kind of felt that we had kind of gone backwards with that.
Well, you see, but that's the thing is that once the space race was won, once we accomplished goal, there was nothing after that. There was nothing after that. All of the astronauts, it was almost a universal thought that all of the astronauts thought that, okay, we beat the Russians to the moon, and then the Russians were also saying, well, we didn't really want to go to the moon anyways. We're going to go for the red planet, and that's where our home is, kind of thing. You know, the red planet being communist. And so the people wanted to go and do the next project. And since Nixon, and I do lay some blame to Nixon, is that the shuttle was just, in his mind, he was not a space guy. He was not like Kennedy. He was not like Johnson. And so he was not a space guy. He was a money guy. And so he just cared about what was the cheapest thing you could do next, which is the shuttle. And all of the NASA officials that we interviewed said, don't do that, because where are you going to go? You're going to go you're going to get the bus, but where's the bus going to go? And so there was no plan to go to somewhere new. And so that's you said, you're talking about stepping backwards.
Right.
It's like, that's why, because there was no futuristic plan for NASA. And even today, I mean, like, NASA is in a mess, but. Right. I think that when I interviewed one of the greatest minds in NASA, he was the guy that first, he was the first flight director at NASA. His name was Chris Kraft. And he was the one that created and developed the first mission control room. He was the first flight director. When we interviewed him like 25 years ago, 20 years ago, he said, the best course of NASA is to get out of the hardware business, let like the Elon Musk of the world, or let the private enterprise construct the hardware, and let the NASA people do the research, do the setting up, and all the, which is kind of like, would you want the government to be making cars and buses and things, or do you want the government to be creating the laws and the regulations and the rules under which we drive? So that's the kind of thought process that this guy had, was get the government out of the manufacturing business and let them look at the big picture of searching for life, doing the research, doing the science, and having that as all under one umbrella.
Absolutely.
And so I do that's think, also
and I do think the technology that they're coming up with is spectacular. I mean, they're able to land the main rocket back on a ship. I mean, that's unheard of what they're doing.
Well,
right now.
Well, but you see, my problem, and I want you to tell your viewing audience not to expect going back to the moon or going on to Mars in anywhere near the time constraints or anywhere near the speed that we went to the moon in the Apollo missions is because this is now not a goal-oriented event. This is like a process-oriented event. So you're going to have multinational companies, multinational corporations working with businesses, working with governments, working with international bodies, and all coming together. So it's the process of working together to go someplace. And that's going to just, the nature of that is going to take much more time. But I have no doubts that we are in a space race now, and my advice is that we need to develop the technologies for here in America, because like one shuttle bay container full of helium-3 could potentially supply all of the electricity for the entire United States for like a full year.
Wow.
And okay. So that's the kind of that and with absolutely zero residuals. There would be zero residual. It's you have helium coming together, creating hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And then that will be burned off. And this is all a zero residual form of energy. But we need to tweak out the technology. And we have to have now an ability to go to the moon to set up a mining colony. And it's like it would be so easy to have automated mining colony. And you just take off the first like foot or two of lunar surface, and then you mine that, you heat that up, you extract the helium-3, then you cool it down into a liquid form, and boom, you've got your energy supply. So no fossil fuels needed, no solar wind, no like wind tunnels off of the northeast coast. And that would supply the entire United States with electricity for a whole year.
Absolutely fantastic.
So, but that's something that's like a benefit to humanity. And so, and the cost would really, if you look at the cost of doing that, setting up a mining colony, setting up an automated version, having like four or five like technicians and people, the amount of money would not be any greater than doing like the Alaska oil pipeline or doing the like the tunnel between the under the English Channel between England and France. So the money you're talking about investing is not any greater than those kinds of projects. It just depends on the will to do that. And then to go to Mars, I have to worry about the fact that we don't have the technology yet. And, you know, it's like when I interviewed NASA officials like 25 years ago, they all said, oh, yeah, we're going to be at the Mars, landing on Mars like 2018 kind of thing. So it's all the technology for self-sustaining for that's like 2.5 or 3 years because you don't want to go spend 2 years to get to Mars and then, you know, like wave a flag and then leave. You have to like stay there for a while.
Right.
So you have to take all your food and electricity and power. And then you have to figure out how to get your power supply for your return trip back. So, and Buzz Aldrin came up with his brilliant idea of having like a, just like a constant, like a train kind of thing going from Mars to Earth. And you just have to get up from the surface up to the orbital rocket. So that's all, it's all in the future of humanity. But it all depends on the desire and the determination. I mean, and if there's people that's like, you know, worrying about like, you know, taxes and things is like, it's not going to happen.
Absolutely.
You have to have like forward thinking, Pat. You know, it's even back in the space race days, it's like people were saying, well, why do you want to go to the moon? Why do you want to go to space? Giving the money to poor people. And so it's like you give the money to poor people and it's just like, okay, so now it's like poor people that are just a little richer, but now you've given up your space technology. And there's so many hundreds of technologies. In fact, I gave the NASA people a great bit of advice that they never did pick up on. And that was to have a NASA logo. You know the NASA logo.
Right.
So for every piece of technology that was developed by the space race, there should have been like a law that every piece of technology, everything that we use now that was developed and created in the old Apollo missions or in the early space days should have like a little, like a logo, like an insignia on that piece so that everybody would constantly be aware that this piece of a home appliance, like a microwave oven or whatever, was developed and created in the old space days, and that's where their money went to. Never picked up. I thought it was a brilliant idea by myself.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. I want to thank you for coming on. I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
I very much appreciated the ability and the cooperation, and you're one of the last of the good guys in my book, because you're keeping the space race, you're keeping the space alive, and the history and everything. And don't forget, buy my book, Space Pioneers, Conversations with the Men of Apollo, available on Amazon.com or my website, GlobalSizeProductions.com.
That works. I would love to have you on again to pick your brain some more. I just loved it. I could sit here for hours and talk to you.
Thank you so very much. I appreciate it. This is one of the benefits of interviewing so many astronauts and NASA people, because I've seen it firsthand. It's undiluted.
Absolutely.
So take care. Thanks so very much.
You too. Have a great evening.
You too. Now. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Okay. I love this stuff. I could, like I said, I could talk to him for hours. Sorry about, you know, I wasn't forming well for speaking. I think I might have been overwhelmed a little bit talking to him. I don't get overwhelmed very often, but I was just in awe of him, and I think that's what the issue was. Tomorrow, I'm not going to be here. Tomorrow, I have something I have to do in the evening. Deraw Mason is going to be the show, and he's going to be talking about, and we've all heard of the Shadow Man. Well, Deraw Mason has come in contact with something even darker and something more malevolent called the Dark Man. And so he has stories about that, and people he's found that have had encounters about that. So he's going to be on tomorrow. It's going to be kind of different, because this was a pre-recorded thing that I did, and I posted it over at our Patreon. And the problem with it was, it turned out that when I had all that memory problem with this laptop last week, I started to delete stuff off of StreamYard and delete stuff off my hard drive because I needed to free up space. Well, the original video for him got deleted. So what's going to happen, and don't anybody panic, tomorrow night I'm going to put the link up on Facebook, put the link up over at YouTube. But you're going to have to go over to Patreon to watch it. I have made the video public, so you can watch it over there, because it's a really good video. Maybe Patreon will get me a copy or something, but I haven't heard from them yet. But it's a really good video, and I think you'll like what he has to say. It's very interesting. So what you have to do, and all you have to do, is go over to Patreon, sign up for a free membership. There's no cost to it, and then you'll have public access to that video. Or you might even have public access, because I did set it for the public. So I'm not sure, you know, if you can just go in there and click on it or what. But just even the free membership there, there's no obligation or cost to check out the video. So that'll be over at the Patreon tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. or whenever you want to do it, because it's already sitting over there. But I do encourage you to see Deraw, you know, that video with Deraw Mason, because it's really, really a good video. All right, guys. There's a lot of things I want to talk about, and I'm probably going to do a video about what's going on with Meetup what is going on tonight? I'm really tired too. I'm probably going to do a video for you guys about the Meetup and what's going on over there, and I'll be posting that on Facebook and maybe over here, because there's a lot going on with that. There's a lot of decisions that have to be made about that. We do have an event coming up. And it's going to be a paid event, $15 per person. And I'll be getting the information out about that. I've got something else I'm doing like at 10 o'clock at night now, like every night. So I'm trying to balance my time and juggle and do all that stuff. But I will have that event up and going. It is for the Halloween season, that event that I'm doing. And, you know, I'm going to be meeting with my team. We're going to try and do a ghost tour in October. So there's a lot of stuff coming up right now. So I'm just trying to, you know, keep my little checklist and keep things going and bring that all out for you guys and have it all set up for you guys. Anyway, be sure to check out the Boot Crew store. I have the link at the bottom of the description of this video. We've got some really cool and fun Halloween shirts over there. So get you ready to, you know, get in that boo mood, right? You get in that boo mood. So go check the store out. We not only have that over there, we have California Haunts merch, California Haunts Radio merch over there as well. So check that out. Like I said, the link is in the description below this video. And I think you'll like going over there. Anyway, I will see you on Thursday. Nancy Matz is going to be on Thursday night. We're switching her day up because I have some special guests coming on Friday that are going to lead into my other show that I want to be doing, you know, about campfire story. Or we decided to change the name of it, call it Ghost Stories by the Campfire. So, you know, that's what the title's going to be. And I wanted to concentrate on 911 rescue people and nurses and things like that. So the guests I'm having on Friday, I hope that they'll participate in that because they are police officers who look into UFO cases and things like that. So yeah, so Nancy's got to do a flip with them. So she will be here at 6:30 on Thursday night, and I do tease that show from DeRoz video as well, so you guys will be informed as to what that show is going to be about. But like I said, the video tomorrow will be shown over at the Patreon. All right, so I'm sorry about that, but unfortunately I was clicking on one too many things to delete and zapped it. Okay, well, I'm going to shut up now, and I will see you guys tomorrow. I will see you guys on Thursday at 6:30 p.m. Pacific with Medium Nancy Matz. Looking forward to that. Hopefully, I'll be better. I'll be awake, you know, more awake. I stayed up all night. That was a lot of my issue. So, yeah. Okay, anyway, I will see you tomorrow. Say I did again. I will see you on Thursday at 6:30 p.m. Pacific, and I'll probably be in the chat room tomorrow if you guys want to chit-chat for that other video over on Patreon. So go ahead, check it out. You know, give you a chance to check out our Patreon too. I'm not trying to lure anybody in. It's just that's where the video is right now. So I believe it's public. You may just be able to go over there and click without even joining the Patreon. But I mean, like I said, there's paid levels of that Patreon and there's a free level. So if you do end up having to join to watch the video, just sign up for the free level. That's all. Okay. All right. I'll see you guys Thursday and have a great evening. Bye.